Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is biologist Rob Dunn. Dunn is a professor in the Department of Biology at North Carolina State University. He is a rising star in popular science journalism and has written dozens of articles for National Geographic, Natural History, Scientific American, and BBC Wildlife magazine. He is author of Every Living Thing, and his most recent book is called The Wildlife of Our Bodies: Predators, Parasites, and Partners That Shape Who We Are Today. It was published in June from Harper. I'm talking to Rob Dunn by phone from his office in Raleigh, North Carolina. Rob Dunn, thank you for joining us. Now, I want to begin by asking a biographical question. Well, what initially sparked your interest in biology?
I've been interested in biology since being a little boy. I was always outside collecting and gathering things. And so the spark has long been there. My father collected snakes and those sorts of things. But when I went to college, I didn't actually know that biology was a thing you could do, and so I started off majoring in economics.
Really?
And then at one point stumbled upon this building full of people who sort of looked like I looked when I was 12 years old. You know, they had dirty shoes and funny hats and lots of equipment for gathering things. It was at that point that the spark met the realization that this is actually something that adult humans can do for a job and get paid.
Wow. Wow. I'm glad you did. Now, we have to talk about The Wildlife of Our Bodies, of course. It's a fascinating book, Rob. I enjoyed every page. Now, you begin with the fact that we humans have gone from lives immersed in nature to lives where nature has pretty much disappeared and we're suffering the consequences. Let's talk about that.
Yeah. So my background is in the interactions of species in general, and so I've worked on ants and termites and trees and birds, and one of the things that's conspicuous in studying species in the wild is that they always interact with other species, typically hundreds of other species. And so if we look at our own story, the vast majority of our lineage's history, we interacted conspicuously with many, many other species that affected every aspect of how we live. We ran scared of predators, our immune systems ran scared of parasites, and we had all sorts of pathogens. And then just very recently, we've made a huge transition, not so much in terms of whether or not we interact with other species, but in terms of the conspicuousness of those interactions and which interactions they are. And so you and I both sitting here talking, we're both still interacting with hundreds, probably thousands of species right now, but they're very different ones from the ones we used to interact with.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about bacteria and stuff that's sitting on our bodies?
Yeah. So I mean, myself, for example, I know I have at least 400 species of bacteria on me and in me. I have mites on my head. I may or may not have a worm. I may have this entirely independent lineage of single-celled life called the Archaeans living on me somewhere. And all of those things, those interactions are going on, and parts of my body know about those interactions, but my conscious brain is pretty unaware. And so we still have this life around us, but it's now very inconspicuous. When we're aware it's there now, our default reaction seems to be to try to kill it. and so that's an unusual place to be.
You talk about how, you know, our need to control our environments have left many of us both physically and psychologically sick. So let's talk about the scrubbed nature of our environments and our bodies and what it's doing to us.
There are two big kinds of scrubs that we've done. And so one is sort of public health, the idea that we essentially no longer poop on our own feet, which for the vast majority of our history was true. And so we had many, many species that relied on us occasionally bumping into feces. And so we had lots of worms, like hookworms. They would crawl into our skin, they get into our bloodstream, go up into our lungs, and then we cough them up and then make their way into our guts. First off, it should be noted that that's an incredibly clever strategy. You know, I have students that are definitely not that clever. But it relies on us bumping into, you know, their eggs in the soil that have come out of feces. And when we started using indoor plumbing, we changed that dramatically. But then the other piece is, in addition to this public health aspect of how we relate to other species, we seem really eager to scrub anything that we view as another species out of our lives. At the one extreme, we do things like using tons and tons of pesticides in our yards, using pesticides in our houses to control roaches and bed bugs, and then using what are essentially pesticides in our bodies, antibiotic wipes and other products. And so 70% of your listeners, well, on average, would use at least some antibiotic cleaning product in their household. One of the very common ones is an antibiotic dishwasher detergent.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it has this compound in it that, in addition to killing bacteria, actually favors some other bacteria. And so there are now bacteria in our houses that eat this compound. Then as we bring this closer to our bodies, what's happening when we do this to our skin? And so mostly we don't think about that, but we're really changing our interactions dramatically.
Mm-hmm. And there's been so much talk about overuse of antibiotics just in general medically.
Yeah, and we do it every day. And so we think in some ways it's due to the doctors, but it's also these decisions we make in the grocery store about whether or not to use those hand wipes.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you look at the studies of what happens when you use these compounds, there's a really nice recent study showing that households that use all the antibiotic wipes and detergents and everything else are no less likely to get sick, the individuals in those households. And in fact, if they already have chronic diseases, they actually appear to be more likely to get sick. Which raises this broader question of what happens when we really get rid of some of these species that we're used to having.
Mm-hmm.
And to come back then to those hookworms, this has really become a prominent aspect of how we think about a lot of immune disorders. And so I don't actually know if I have had a worm in my life, but most people on Earth historically had one or another kind of worm in their body, either during childhood or as an adult. And many people probably had more kinds of worms than one. So as we look globally at what happens when we started to get rid of those worms, an interesting thing has begun to emerge, which is that in precisely those places where we've done the best job at getting rid of these worms that clearly in many regards are bad, we've also started to see all of these immune disorders popping up
mm-hmm.
with increasing frequency.
Mm-hmm. You talk about Crohn's disease.
Crohn's disease, yeah, inflammatory bowel disease, even rheumatoid arthritis. And so it's a big laundry list of these diseases that become more common precisely in those places where we've done a good job, quote-unquote, in getting rid of these other species. And so it raises lots of interesting questions.
Yeah, so the theory is that maybe we're getting rid of things that our immune systems actually needed in order not to, you know, attack ourselves. You talk a lot about that in your book.
Yeah, so I think of it like a kind of gravity. Plants evolved with gravity as a predictable aspect of their environment. Gravity was never good for them. And yet if you take a plant that's used to gravity and grow it in a zero-gravity sort of condition, it grows very strangely, and it wastes a lot of energy because it's invested all of this architecture, this evolutionary architecture, in figuring out ways to deal with the presence of gravity. In the same way, I think that's what our bodies have done with worms, that our immune systems evolved with worms as a dependable presence. And so they're as active as they would need to be given the presence of the worms. And then you take those worms out, and they continue to be that active, even though they no longer have something to deal with. And I think that this may be at the root of a lot of these diseases. And there's, you know, you don't want to rest too much on just correlative studies, but there have actually been some good experiments. And so on the one extreme, there's a really nice study in Iowa showing that if you take individuals who have Crohn's disease and you give them a glass of Gatorade with some pig whipworms in it.
That sounds
they
so
drink,
awful.
I suspect it still tastes a little slimy. I don't actually know. But
they've had good results, right?
They did have good results. And so all but one of the patients in that trial actually saw remission of their Crohn's symptoms, which is amazing because Crohn's is one of these diseases that it doesn't really have a very good treatment in many
mm-hmm.
cases.
Mm-hmm. Well, none of the autoimmune diseases do, is what I understand. So, you know, bring on the worms, I suppose.
Yeah, I think in some ways, although we want to do it with some control, I
mm-hmm.
think is one of the issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about how we also transition from being hunter-gatherers to agriculturists and how this has changed our diet so completely. Talk to us about our addictions to sugary and processed foods.
Yeah, so I think this aspect of our evolution is just fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
We evolved under conditions in which many of our basic kinds of foods were limiting. I'm talking now not just about the last million years or 10 million years, but really for most of our vertebrate history, many of the foods we needed, we didn't get enough of them, and so we had to search them out. And so those included sweet things and savory things, which is to say essentially fatty things and
mm-hmm.
salty things. We were salt limited for millions of terrestrial years. And so if you think about how our bodies responded to that evolutionarily, one of the things that happened is that we evolved taste buds that essentially rewarded us for finding those things. You know, good dog.
Mm-hmm.
And so our taste buds call out to us, you know, I need more sugar, I need more salt, I need more fat. and reward us when we find those things. And it's really very arbitrary what our taste buds respond to. I mean, if you think about something like a dung beetle, its taste buds reward it when it tastes, or its smell rewards it when it smells poop, which to it clearly is delicious. But for us, that's not what we needed. We needed sweet and salt and savory. And so for millions of years, that worked. That reward system kept sending us out to look for things. But then with the origin of agriculture, we started to become able to actually produce foods in large quantities that we historically needed, and rewarded those sensory biases. And then we have no part of our body which tells us to stop eating them, mm-hmm. because there was no point historically when we had enough. And so we go around with these tongues that, you know, exercise a kind of sensory morality telling us what's good and bad, but they're wrong now about what we need.
Yeah, well, we're also much less active, and that's a factor that we haven't taken into consideration, hence the obesity epidemic, correct?
Yeah, so I think it's two key pieces of the obesity epidemic are changes in activity, and then also the failure of our bodies to recognize that our circumstances have changed. And, you know, so we now produce a huge proportion of American agriculture is geared toward producing sugar, which is, you know, partially product of marketing, but also the product of our tongues marketing to our conscious brains what we need.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we only listen to our urges, our evolutionary urges, we will produce a world that's essentially biased toward what we used to need, which is an amazing thing, and our visual system does it too. We think we're consciously making decisions, but the subconscious, which is very ancient, has a strong pull.
Mm-hmm. I like the way you talk about the fact that so many people on this earth are starving, and we've dedicated so many hundreds and thousands of miles of farmland to non-nutritional foods like sugar beets and so on. Do you have any solutions for how we can turn this around?
So I think there are no really simple solutions, but I think a key aspect is to start to become conscious of the decisions we're making about other species. And this applies to things like, you know, choosing to plant so much sugar. I mean, the really extreme and crazy example is turf grass. So the biggest crop in the U.S. right now is actually turf grass lawns, which have no real functional value and entail this huge expenditure in terms of oil. And one could argue about why we're doing that. Part of that's cultural. There may be some sensory biases there, too. But I think the bigger answer is we need to really consciously think about which species are we favoring and which species are we disfavoring, and how do we make those decisions in a way that's actually sensible, mm-hmm. not just as individuals, because as individuals we're flawed, we're biased thanks to all of this evolutionary baggage. They need to be social decisions. But as a simple example, in terms of the products we choose, the foods we choose, the species we choose, our default seems to be to choose those things we used to need. By the same token, if we think about which species live around us, our default seems to be to try to kill anything we don't know very much about. And so if you look around you in your house, which species are likely to live with you? Well, it's species that are sneaky, species that get by our filters. And so I think in a world where we had chosen really well, we would have species that benefit us around us. But instead, what we end up with are species that can avoid pesticides, species that can avoid our perception. And so that's why, so rats that live in our houses have actually evolved the ability, which wild rats don't have to a greater extent, to walk along walls and cling to walls and be almost exclusively nocturnal. Which is new, and the same for bed bugs. They've evolved all these new behaviors in association with humanity for being sneaky. And so when we're not thoughtful about what we have around us, that's what we get. We get a world filled with sneaky, sometimes deadly things.
If you're just joining us, my guest is biologist Rob Dunn. We're talking about his book, The Wild Life of Our Bodies. You know what I want you to talk about? I want you to talk about the evolution of our relationship with the African bird, the honey guide. I found that such a compelling story that you told about that.
Sure. So the honey guide is this amazing bird that eats the wax in honeybee hives, which is a really unusual diet. The wax is very difficult to digest, and so it does a very special thing. And the honey guide has evolved the ability to find honeybee hives, and it's very, very good at it. But the problem is it's not very good at getting into the hives. And so a relationship actually evolved between the honey guide and hunter-gatherers in parts of Africa, whereby the honey guide would actually fly to villages and wait for someone to come out and lead it. It would then lead them to a honeybee hive with these very stereotyped behaviors, where the humans would go and get the honey, and the bird could go and then get the wax. And so there's very good evidence for this relationship having an evolutionary component and for benefiting the bird. And it clearly benefited the humans, too, because this evolved during a time in which it was very, very difficult to get honey. And so there are all these very interesting cultural phenomena that relate to this relationship. And nobody's actually been able to show any evidence for other animals leading the honey guide, going with the honey guide to honeybee hives so they can get the wax out. And so it seems to be a bird and human relationship, which as an ecologist and evolutionary biologist, I find almost intrinsically beautiful. There's just some elegance in the relationship.
I thought about Tinkerbell when you talked about this little bird fluttering around waiting for some human to pay attention to it. Absolutely, absolutely magical.
No, it really is. I love the idea of Tinkerbell because I think that's very much what it is. I'm waiting to lead you on. Just see me, and we'll go and we'll find the sweet stuff. I think that's a great image.
And are these relationships still going on in modern times, or have the honey guides been eradicated?
They're going on in some places to a very limited extent, but what's happened is that the honey in wild honeybee hives is no longer the easiest honey to get. And I should say that it's not easy to get honey out of wild honeybee hives. The bees are aggressive, mm-hmm. They're high up, it's dangerous, you get stung. And so what essentially ruined this relationship were sugar beets, but also lollipops. And so it's now much easier to go to the store than it is to follow this honey guide who now still comes to the villages and waits and flutters there like Tinkerbell, but fewer and fewer people notice. And so the birds actually become more and more rare in many of the regions in which it's found.
Wow, that's an amazing story.
No, and I mean it's at once a beautiful evolutionary story and kind of a tragic moral story of the changes we've made and who we relate to.
Mm-hmm.
And isn't it so much more lovely to have a relationship like the one we had with the honey guide than it is to have a relationship like the one we have with big sugar industries?
Indeed. You know what I want to talk about, too, before we run out of time? I want to talk about our ancient fear response. You talk a lot about that, and it made sense when we were, when we were being chased by predators. But now you sort of correlate it to anxiety disorders and so on. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, so often when I give talks, in the middle of the talk, I'll just scream for just a second. And one of the amazing things that happens is that people have a very immediate startle response. And we know exactly what happens during that startle response. And so one of the things that will happen is you'll get goosebumps. And goosebumps are sort of an easy entry into the story because what happens with goosebumps? Well, it's these teeny tiny muscles in your skin that are essentially making your hair stand up on end. Well, why does that happen? That, like many of the things associated with fear, happens because it was once useful. When we used to have long hair, it stood on end. It made us look bigger and scarier. And maybe if there was a leopard outside of our community, there was some odds that it would go away.
Mm.
But now, in our modern context, with our essentially bald bodies, it's just ridiculous. And this is just one of many pieces of evolutionary baggage we have that relates to predators. And here, I think a useful context is to remember is that early on, our primate ancestors were about the size of a Big Mac. And only slowly did we get bigger and bigger. And so for most of our history, we were eaten by leopards, by other cats. We were eaten by eagles. One of the best fossil skulls we have of a hominid, it has two giant talon holes right through the eyes. We talk about the Wright brothers being first in flight. That was probably actually the... And then snakes. And so if you look at those primate species today who have what I would call nouns, words to describe things, the words they tend to have are essentially, oh, no snake, oh, no eagle, oh, no cat, which is exactly the words vervet monkeys have. Now, fast forward to our modern lives, we mostly killed off the big predators. We still love them in some sort of way, which is why they're on the covers of all the National Geographic and Smithsonian magazines. But they're mostly gone, and so the odds of being eaten by a leopard in New York City are remarkably low. But our bodies still have the ancient effects of all those predators. And so those were our goosebumps, but they're also the broader fear response. And that fear response is mediated by our amygdala, and it causes now all sorts of problems in our daily lives. And so most of our trouble with fear and anxiety, which is, I would say, a very, very prevalent set of problems, stem from that ancient relationship with predators. And those fears and anxieties don't really play a functional role anymore in most cases, but they're still there. And so I think there's an argument for many of the anti-anxiety medications that people are taking now is essentially being a way to quash the ghosts of our ancient predators. And we don't think about it that way, but it's just another one of these ways that our daily lives are really enmeshed in our who we were and who we interacted with. And the more I look into these stories, the more it seems clear that we can't escape, that we're part of this much bigger story and this much larger number of species. And this idea that we're out there on our own, the person on the island making decisions, seems less and less true, I think.
Yeah, well, you talk about how when we used to be afraid of predators, we would flee, and you jokingly say, it's hard for us to flee from unbalanced checkbooks now.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, so I'm driving down the road and I realize I'm late, all of those same anxiety responses that if there was a leopard after me would have made sense. But when I'm driving to a meeting, make no sense whatsoever. So I get goosebumps. My cortisol goes up. My heartbeat goes up. I start to look around in a really alert way. All of which, when I'm trying to drive to a meeting, is totally stupid and non-functional. But I can't get out in front of it because it's there. It's really deep in my brain. And even though I know what's happening, I can't stop it, which I think is just really amazing.
Well, do you think as a biologist there would be a better way for us to use that ancient tendency in instead of taking drugs and letting the fear make no sense? How could we channel that?
Well, that's a really good question. I think for clinicians to be aware that that's part of what's going on when they're treating these disorders has the potential to change how we think about treating them. I guess I'm too far away myself from being part of that clinical story and knowing what's going on. But I guess I would hope that these sorts of concepts could ideally permeate the fields related to dealing with our anxiety and stress and change in some ways how we think about our anxiety and stress.
Yeah. Well, we think of ourselves as modern and having evolved, and we really are still reacting as ancient people.
And we are. I mean, uh-huh. we're so ancient. We have such flawed bodies in their modern context, and we're also still just so ignorant of what's going on about our bodies. I mean, when I was just starting off as a scientist, and I still do it today, it's really easy to imagine that if you look at some part of your body or some part of the world outside, that somebody understands it. But the truth, as often as not, is that no one really understands it well. And so in this context, one of the really striking examples is the appendix.
Ah, yes.
I don't know how much time we have left, but the short version of the story of the appendix is that historically we tended to think it was a vestige of, it served our ancestors for some purpose, but not us anymore. And just in the last couple of years, Bill Parker at Duke Medical Center offered the hypothesis that maybe our appendix served the function of storing good bacteria up so that in those cases where we got a really severe infection like cholera, our guts could then be recolonized by good bacteria. And so a fair amount of evidence accrued for this, and it was really exciting and totally new, and Bill essentially came up with it by sitting on a stool in his lab, spinning around and thinking. Well, so just this year, and it's about to come out, there's a new paper showing that individuals who don't have their appendix are at an increased risk from an infection called Clostridium difficile, which is a really common hospital infection that kills quite a few people in the U.S. every year.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially what appears to be going on is when you don't have your appendix and you take lots of antibiotics, your gut bacteria, your good bacteria get cleared out, and they can't. There's no place for them to be recolonized from.
Wow.
And so then this bad bacteria takes over. And so this is just, I mean, it's just a totally radical rethink about what an organ in our body does. And so to me, you know, there's one very specific lesson about the appendix, but the broader lesson is that, I mean, here we are in 2011. We think we're beginning to understand things, and yet there are organs in our bodies that are so poorly understood that somebody can spin around in the stool in their lab and come up with a new idea that might be right.
That's amazing. So our bodies really are still outer space. We haven't discovered who we are yet in many ways.
Oh, no. I mean, and we've started doing a lot of work on bacteria on people's skin, and in the first 200 people we've looked at, and we've been looking at belly buttons, both because it's sort of interesting ecologically and just silly enough that people are engaged. In the first 200 people, we found 4,000 species of bacteria, most of them totally new to science. And for the most part, we don't know what the vast majority of those species are doing.
I was just going to say, have you found any function for them?
Yeah, so it is known that in general the overall microbial fauna on your skin has several functions. And so one is it's sort of your first line of defense. And so if you were to really scrub the microbes off of your skin when washing your hands super vigorously with antibiotic wipes, you would stand a higher chance of getting sick because you just open up that habitat for colonization by nasty pathogens. But the other, they do all sorts of other things, too. And so almost all of the smells on your body are produced by microbes. And so that's the lovely smell of your partner's hair, right, is a microbial smell. But also the smell of body odor. And that, it turns out, is being produced by corynebacteria in people's armpits that appear to actually actively be fed by these apocrine sweat glands in armpits that no one has figured out any function for them yet aside from producing compounds that feed those bacteria that make those smells. And so all these things are going on in our bodies, and they involve species that don't have names yet. Sometimes we can't even tell you what family they're in.
Wow, this is amazing. We're still discovering so much. It's still an exciting world for scientists, correct?
Yeah, it's very much like, I mean, beginning to study human bodies, it's like being Lewis and Clark of the everyday life. It's so fun and interesting, and then every so often you realize it's also incredibly consequential that, you know, these are species that can save or kill us, and so we need to know about them.
Rob Dunn, we are almost out of time. Do you have any contact information so people can get in touch or check out your book or, you know, talk to you about these issues?
Yeah, so if you log into yourwildlife.org, you can actually sign up for projects to have your belly button sampled, to have your house sampled for species, or check out my magazine writing or the book, The Wildlife for Our Bodies.
Well, Rob Dunn, thank you so much. This was an absolute treat for me to read this book. It's absolutely fascinating. Everybody go out and get this book. You'll learn so much about your world and so much about your own life. Rob Dunn, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Tish. I really enjoyed it.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.